You are listening to the Passion City Church DC podcast. To learn more about Passion City Church, including our gathering times in Atlanta and Washington, D.C., visit us online at PassionCityChurch.com. Today's talk comes from Pastor Ben Stewart.
Well, if you know me at all, you've heard me say that through a unique set of circumstances, I have had the honor of spending quality time with Navy SEALs. And I count that as a great honor because I am continuously inspired by their clarity of purpose and challenged by their commitment to hone their skills for their purposes. So I've watched them leap from helicopters. I've watched them use all manner of weapons. I've watched them use hand-to-hand combat. I remember one of them teaching me some things about it. And at the end of it, he said, you know, that's really what life's about. He said, it's just about getting a little bit deadlier every day. And I was like, oh, okay. I thought you were going to say better, but deadlier works fine too. And wow. And I've watched them hone their ability to use force and then hone the responsibility of how much to use and when. And I'm always inspired by that community and the training they do to prepare for what they are called to do for our country. And I remember at one point gathering with a group of guys and some friends when they had just gotten back from a training called Halo School. And they were showing us a video of it, this evolution. Halo is an acronym. It stands for High Altitude, Low Opening. It's a parachuting school. And it's not just for SEALs, all manner of the military uses it, but it's a very intense school. You spend maybe half a day in the classroom, and then the next day, they're shoving you out of airplanes. And when he was showing us this video of the class he'd gotten back from, it starts with this kind of air of silliness. Like, I'll never forget the first guy in the video, they shove him out of the plane. And even if you've never parachuted in your life, you kind of know you're supposed to lean down, face the earth. This guy, as soon as he hits the air, he just starts running. And we're watching him, we're like, there's no traction up there, man, lean, right? And it looks silly. They had him in these baby blue outfits with big handlebars so the coaches could move them in the air. And if they opened their mouths, their cheeks would flap. They look silly. And yet with every successive jump, they learn some new skill, how to move their body at exact degrees, how to tack at over 100 miles an hour. And with each jump, they started to look less and less funny and more impressive. And then I remember towards the end of the video, I noted a shift in the room. I noted that none of us were laughing anymore. As we watched the men load in the plane for their final jump, they weren't in the baby blue jumpsuits anymore. They were in dark colors, jungle greens and blacks. They had 60 pounds of gear strapped to their chest, including weapons. When they loaded on the plane, they didn't look nervous. And when the moment came, they leapt out without hesitation. And I remember as I watched them descend through the night sky, it suddenly dawned on me why we weren't laughing in the room anymore. Because we realized what we were watching. These weren't some guys taking a parachuting class for fun. These were warriors training for a mission. The high altitude is so the enemy can't hear the plane. The low opening is so you spend minimal time out in the air as an open target. And the reason they're doing this, being inserted behind enemy lines, is to rescue those who are in jeopardy and to wreak havoc upon those who oppress men. And I remember watching that and the thought crossing my mind, that is Christmas. I don't know what you think about when you think about Christmas. I don't know when someone asks you what's the reason for the season. If you're like, well, it's family or presents or Jesus, but little. I don't know what you say, but let me give you a biblical answer. Next time someone asks you, what does Christmas mean to you? You can say, when I think of Christmas, I think destruction. Yeah, the reason for the season is destruction. And you'd be biblical in thinking that. And you go, well, Ben, where are you getting this from? Well, we just read it in 1 John chapter 3, verse 8. He says, the Son of God appeared for this purpose, to destroy the works of the devil. Jesus came to destroy something. The reason we celebrated Christmas a month ago is because God wanted something destroyed. Now, I know some of you hear that and you're like, wait, what? No, Jesus came to save people and to bring peace and to heal people. What are you talking about? But it makes sense if you think about it. For him to save people necessarily means someone's holding you captive. For him to bring peace necessarily implies we're in a state where there is no peace. And for him to heal means there's a sickness that has to be cut out. And our liberation required destruction. And if we're going to enter this year with any understanding of what God is doing in the world, then we need to appreciate that our God wants something destroyed. And so that leads to some natural questions. What did Jesus come to destroy? How did he do it? And then number three is, how do we participate in that destroying work. What did he come to destroy? Well, our passage says he came to destroy the works of the devil. Now, I know some people hear that, and particularly in a sophisticated city like this, we're like, the devil, really? Like horns, red jumpsuit, little tail? You really believe in that? Well, let me just say, if you don't believe in any kind of dark spiritual power in the world, then you have to come up with a philosophy sufficient to explain why something as beautiful as humanity will do the horrible things we do to each other. How do you explain 300,000 dead in Somalia because warlords used hunger as a weapon? You go, well, it's a lack of education, Ben. When Oprah's done, it'll be fine. Well, how do you explain 11 million dead in Nazi Germany, one of the most educated nations of its day? You say, well, we've evolved since then. Well, how do you explain the millions killed by their own government in the 20th century? How do you explain our own hearts? We violate our own integrity. How much more that of a holy God? It's fascinating. If you look back in Genesis, you see humanity has amazing capacity. You see the rise of technology and you see the rise of the arts. And yet you see with morality and the way we treat each other, the hostility and the way we use one another, it goes down. Humanity has this glorious potential in technology and in culture, but morally something's wrong. And you see it today. I marvel at the internet. That humanity started with rocks and trees and grass. And we're like, you know, we pile some of these rocks together, we can create the internet. It's amazing. And yet, what do we fill it with? We're so cruel to each other. And for some reason in history, we can't figure this out. And there's a sickness in us. And there's a darkness in us. And we can't fix it. And I've quoted many times the article by Matthew Paris about Africa, where he looked as an atheist working with NGOs to provide clean water and structure and stability, him finally saying, all that's good, but the best changes I've seen are the spiritual changes. There's a need for a heart renovation. He said, I don't want to believe in this. I don't want to say this is true, but Africa needs God, and so do you, and so do I. And so the reality is our world has a spiritual darkness to it. And that doesn't mean there aren't political problems that need political solutions. It doesn't mean there's not physical problems that require physical solutions. It doesn't mean any of that. But it does mean there's a spiritual darkness in here, and we have to see that side of things too. It's fascinating. I read two books over the last 2 years of men who didn't believe in God, came to believe in God, not because of the beauty of creation, but because of the darkness they saw in the world. One of them was a father who watched his son lose everything beautiful about him to his addiction to meth. And as the dad, as a journalist, began to study this drug and how it's designed to steal humanity from us, he began to say, I don't believe in God, but he wrote, but only the devil could create this. And then he found himself, as he peered into the darkness in America, falling on his knees and begging the God he didn't believe in to have mercy on us, because there's a darkness he couldn't pierce himself. And he came to believe in God because he needed him, because he saw there's a darkness out here beyond the political, beyond the philosophical. There's a deeper issue inside of us, and it's a spiritual one, and it transcends time, it transcends race, it transcends gender and history, and the Bible says it's orchestrated. And it calls him the devil, which just means accuser, or Satan, which is the Hebrew word for adversary. Jesus called him the ruler of this world. The Apostle Paul said he's the God of this age. John said in 1 John, we know we're of God, and the whole world lies in the power of this evil one. And Ephesians 2 says he's the spirit now at work in the sons of disobedience, which sounds like a bad band name. But it's talking about us. What is his work? Well, verse 8 said, the one who practices sin is of the devil, for the devil has sinned from the beginning. That word sin's thrown around a lot. It basically means to miss the mark. It means there was something we were meant to hit and we didn't hit it. There was something we're meant to be and we're not it. We all feel that. I haven't risen to the level of the capacity I feel inside. I have fallen short of the glory of God. And it says earlier in the passage, everyone who practices sin practices lawlessness. Sin is lawlessness. Now, what that means is not that God has a checklist up there and like, did you just cuss? You're crossed off Santa's list. That's not what it's talking about. It's talking about that God created laws to govern all that he's made. And we see this most clearly in physical laws, that the earth spins around the sun and it spins on its axis to give us seasons. There are physical laws that govern the world, and they make sense. The book of Proverbs says, by wisdom, the foundations of creation were laid. And then it says, of wisdom, all her paths are peace. The word peace there is the word shalom in Hebrew. And that's not just the absence of conflict, it's the presence of flourishing. That when everything works the way God designed it, there's shalom, there's flourishing. And the reality is there's physical laws. The rain falls and it hits the crops and the crops grow and they feed us and we till the soil. There's something rhythmic about the way the world works. And as all works as it should, all win. And it moves to relational laws. Men are meant to love and cherish women. Women are meant to encourage and honor men. And as we work together, we're meant to bless one another and everybody wins. Husbands and wives love each other and then they love their children. They see the gifts God put in that kid and they help develop those so their children can grow up and use those gifts for the common good so we all flourish. When we all live the way God intended by his law, if you will, everyone flourishes. There's peace, there's shalom. That's Genesis 1 and 2. And it says that Satan has been sinning from the beginning. He came to upend all of that. And God created the man and woman to rule over the animal realm. And Satan comes as an animal to deceive them, to have them rebel against the author of life. And he convinced them of a lie, that to really enjoy life, you have to rebel against the author of life. That his laws aren't freedom for you, they're restrictions. So you take control and you do things your own way and you bend reality to your will. And they bought that lie, the lie many of us have, that you say, I'll control my life, thank you very much. I'll take it where I want it to go. I'll grab control. And guess what? They went to get that knowledge of good and evil and they got it. They got the control, they got the knowledge, but then they got some things they didn't expect. They got shame. And many of us know what that's like. I'll take control, my life, my body, my choices, I'll do it, I'll do whatever I want. And then we look and go, but why don't I feel right? And God came to them and said, the ground's cursed because of you. I made you ruler over this and you broke fellowship with me, everything breaks. The ground breaks, thorns and thistles will grow, nothing will work right anymore, work will be frustrating. And then he looked at the man and woman and said, and your conflicts relationally will be exacerbated. It will be difficult to work among the genders, which some of you are like, I know that's right. Yeah, I know too. Yeah, there's difficulty here. And he looks and he says, the whole world is broken because of what's happened. There's a devastation here. And flowing from that garden is the sickness we see in all of us that is the driving force spiritually behind every person who charges into a school with a gun, and every weird, insecure thing you say at a party because you're desperate for attention. All the weird particularities of our sickness flow from that deception. Alexander Solzhenitsyn said it this way, if only there were evil people somewhere committing evil deeds and it were necessarily only to separate them from the rest of us and destroy them, wouldn't that be nice? He says, but the line dividing good and evil cuts through every human heart. If we're destroying evil, then none of us are saved. And so what does God do? What did he do when he went back in the garden? Did he walk in and say, what have you done? Hey, I'm gonna leave for about a millennia or two. And when I come back, I better see some shalom in here. Is that what he does? Give him a list of rules? No, what does he do? He looks at the serpent and says, I'm gonna put enmity, that means hatred, between you and this woman, between your seed and hers. And then he does something weird. He refers to the seed of the woman with a singular male pronoun, he. There's a boy coming. That's the seed of a woman, which is a weird thing to call a boy because women don't have seed. I'm not gonna talk about that. You can ask John or anyone on the worship team about that later. But there's a unique boy coming. And notice what he says. He will crush the head of the one who deceived you. That God's solution to the sin in our world is a savior. We need rescue. And so how did Jesus destroy his work? Notice in our text it said, by his appearing. That Jesus' arrival on the planet was a landed invasion. Think about it, the beginning of his earthly ministry. How did it start? He was baptized, remember, in the Jordan, and the heavens broke open, the Spirit descended, the Father spoke, that's my boy, I'm so proud of him. And what's the next thing that happened? He was out in the desert, and Satan was coming at him, trying to get him to doubt the goodness of God, go his own way, take control. And Jesus is fighting him off with Deuteronomy quotes. And do you remember finally in desperation, the devil says, I'll give you everything. I will give you every kingdom. Just stop doing what you're here to do. And you remember Jesus' response? No, thanks. And he left. It's a rough translation, but it's in there. And it says he marched back in the power of the Holy Spirit. He walked straight to the synagogue. He walked in front of everyone. They handed him a scroll. He turned without pause to chapter 68 of Isaiah. It says, the Spirit of the Lord is upon me because he anointed me to preach the gospel to the poor and proclaim release to the captives. We know this about him. He preaches and he loves the poor. But then he says, but I'm here to set captives free. And then he ended the sermon by saying, this is being fulfilled right now. And he marched out of that synagogue and did damage against the darkness, pushing back the evil in us. He came to women whose lives had been devastated sexually and relationally, and he gave them dignity and hope back. He came to men who had ruined every relationship and their pursuit of greed, and he gave them hope and a future and a family. You saw him move the darkness back spiritually, demons fleeing in his presence because of his power. One of my favorite explanations of his ministry. Jesus was asked once why he's here. Why are you here? It'd be interesting to think about it. If someone asked you that, how would you answer it? Jesus looks at him and says, well, picture a strong guy covered in armor. He's got a bunch of stuff. No one will mess with him. Now picture a stronger guy beating him up, stripping his armor, and stealing his things. That's me. Try that next time your friend asks you about your religious commitments. What's all this about? Well, Jesus is, he's like this big guy who beats someone up and steals his possessions. That's my God. I mean, that's who I love. Luke chapter 11, verse 21. When a strong man fully armed guards his house, his possessions are undisturbed. But when someone stronger than he attacks him and overpowers him, he takes away from him all his armor on which he relied and distributes his plunder. Read the text later. The plunder was us. The strong man was the devil who held us captive. And Jesus said, I'm here to wreck shop and set you free. Why were demons screaming in terror when he showed up? Because the stronger one is here. And let me tell you something, church. I don't know what addiction or struggle or hopelessness is threatening to bury you and telling you you are powerless in its presence. You probably are. But the good news of the gospel is there's a stronger one here. One of my favorite moments is when he came up to a guy who was possessed by demons and the demon screamed, Son of God, are you here to torment us before the appointed time? It's like they knew a whooping was coming. They just thought he was early. They're like, what? No, so much to do. He reaches the pinnacle of his earthly ministry. He shows up on a mountaintop and tells his disciples, we're about to march to Jerusalem. They're going to reject me and murder me there. And you remember Peter sidebars him, starts to try to encourage him. Hey, no messiahs are dying on my watch, man. Let's quit that negativity. And Jesus looks past Peter to that, to the cause of that statement, and says, get behind me, Satan. Satan is trying to keep Jesus from that cross. But Luke tells us Jesus set his face like stone toward Jerusalem. And on the night he was betrayed, John 12, Jesus said, now is the judgment of the world. Now the ruler of the world will be cast out. He said in John 16, 11, the ruler of this world is judged. And Jesus judged and condemned Satan and sin. How? By perpetrating violence? No. Hebrews 2 says, therefore, since the children share in flesh and blood, that's you and me, he himself partook of the same. He became like us. That through death, he might render powerless him who had the power of death, that is the devil, and might free those who through fear of death were subject to slavery all their lives. He says, you bound to the fear of death? Why are we afraid of death? Because we know we'll die guilty. That's what Paul told the Corinthians. The sting of death is sin, and the poison of it is the law of knowing I'm not right when I die. I had a friend struck by lightning. It's how he came to Christ. Not metaphorically, like I was living crazy. And then one day it was like a bolt of lightning. God literally hit him with a bolt of lightning. And he literally came to faith. And he said the first thought that came to his mind as the bolt hit him was, I'm dead. And the second thought was, and I'm not ready. Because he knew there's something wrong with me and it's not dealt with. And he went on a search and he found a God who would take on our physical flesh, take on your sin and shame and bear it on that cross. And he who knew no sin became sin for you and for me, that we could be right with God. And Paul told the Colossians, you were dead in your transgressions and the uncircumcision of your flesh, but he made you alive together with him, having forgiven us all our transgressions, canceling out the certificate of death consisting of decrees against us, which was hostile to us. He took it out of the way, nailing it to the cross. And when he had disarmed the rulers and authorities, he made a public display of them, having triumphed over them through him. For many of us, you feel guilty because you are. You're beautiful in the image of God, but something's desperately wrong with all of us. And yet God's done something decisive about it. Jesus said, give me that certificate of death, the transgressions that are condemning you and against you, and nail it to me. I will take the sin. I will take the shame. I will take the requisite death that comes from it, and I will bury it in the grave with me, and what I do will set you free. And a big question is, well, how do we know if it worked? How do we know that wasn't some crazy guy centuries ago wishful thinking? We know it because the ground began to shake and the stone was rolled away and his perfect love could not be overcome. Now, death, where is your sting? The resurrected king rendered you defeated. We know because Jesus took our sin and buried it, and then that stone moved and he walked out and said, there is forgiveness now for you and me. Your weight can be cast aside and a new life given to you because I have triumphed over the enemy. His great sword and your life was your unforgiven sin, and I knocked it out of his hand by paying for it on that cross, and I triumphed over him for you. That's the gospel. It's interesting, the word triumph is used a couple times in the New Testament, like it was here. And it was actually an event. Back then, they would all know what it was. A triumph was like a parade. See, back then, if we were part of a village or a town or a city that was being attacked, that's kind of scary. If a rebel king was attacking us, it's a bad thing, because if they won our town, they would murder all the men and enslave the women. It's a bad deal for the town. And so if your king rides out to fight against him, you want your king to win. You're invested in that activity. And so when you find out he won, you're thrilled because his victory counts for you. And when you find out your king has been victorious, you're not like, oh, great, we'll tell him congrats. Next time I see him, I'll say thanks. No, you're like, what are we about to do? And they say, well, the king is coming home. And you don't say, well, tell him hi. You go, well, then we're gonna get this place ready. And so if the central road of town has little valleys in it, the valleys are filled up. If there's hills, the hills are brought low, and you make straight a path for your king. And on the day of his arrival, he's not gonna ride in with the gore of battle still on him. He's gonna go get cleaned up. He's gonna put on his best robes. He's gonna mount a white horse or a chariot pulled by a white horse. And on the day of the triumph, all of us would come out to the central thoroughfare, stand along the road to welcome in the king. And as the king rode in, we would see him in his glory riding, our victorious conquering king, and we would celebrate him. And then right behind him usually, sometimes tied to the chariot, was the king who had tried to kill us, the king who had tried to pillage us and abuse us. And he would be stripped of his armor, sometimes even stripped of his clothes, because naked people out on the streets look ridiculous. And the thought behind that was the thing you were most scared of is now powerless before your king. And so he took your greatest fear and he strips out of his power. So you'd see your king victorious. You'd see the king that was threatening you broken. And then there was one other group walking in the triumph. It was those who'd been rescued from slavery, those who had been captured. They would put on robes of white linen, bright and clean. They would carry censers of incense that they would swing in the presence of the king. Scent is the sense most tied to memory. And the idea was, I want to fill your life, your memory, and me most of all with the aroma of the victory of my king. Listen to what Paul said to the Corinthians in 2 Corinthians 2. Thanks be to God who always leads us in triumph in Christ and manifests through us the sweet aroma of the knowledge of him in every place. See, there's two ways that Jesus destroys the work of the devil. One was his space-time appearance in history and on the cross. And the other is his space-time appearance in your life. When he says, no longer, child, no longer are you a slave to what's holding you captive. I'm here to set you free. No longer are you going to participate in a freedom that led to bondage. I'm going to lead you into a kingdom that liberates you. I'm setting you free from sin and shame and giving you hope and a future. He destroys the work of the devil in us when we put our faith in the conquering king. Colossians says he delivers us out of the kingdom of darkness into the kingdom of the beloved son, in whom we have redemption, the forgiveness of sins. That's what you and I need this new year. We don't need the turnover of a new leaf of new activities. We need a new identity. We don't just need a couple solutions. We need a new constitution. And God says, I want to change you from the inside out. And so if you noticed in our passage, John begins to use this seed imagery in birth. It's like God plants his seed in you and you come alive. It's like you're born again and you bear the seed of your father. You look like him. My children look like me. Not to become my children, but because they are. They begin to manifest my particularities and they begin to incorporate my values. They begin to become more like me because they're my kids. And he says that we've been born again and a seed abides in us, so we cannot keep on sinning. We don't revel in what our king came to destroy. But when we put our faith in him, he begins to change us. Things that used to hold us captive, we no longer are bound to. Things we used to be addicted to, we now find abhorrent. Things we weren't interested in, we're now interested in. Some of you have experienced that. When I put my faith in Jesus, some things I used to rely on, I don't want to lean on anymore. Some things I used to not care about, I suddenly care deeply about. He's changing me from the inside out, from identity to activity. That's how it works. And so he's calling us to faith and says, I want to change you from the inside out. And he says, beloved, no one born of God practices sin. His seed abides in him. He cannot sin because he's born of God. Now, before we close, let me just clarify. Some people hear that and go, you cannot sin if you're born of God? Question. I put my faith in Jesus and I might have sinned today. I might have screamed some sins when that 17-degree weather hit me as I walked out the door. I might have sinned just to get the kids in the car. I didn't know how else to get them in the car. Is this passage teaching sinless perfection? Well, no, and the ESV translation does a good job here that the verb cannot sin. It's put in the present tense. It means continuous active. It means you don't go on sinning. That someone who's born of God does not perpetually, unrepentantly indulge in what the king came to destroy. I don't want to love what he bled out to set me free from. And so there should be a change of identity and a change of activity. But you don't have to know Greek verb tenses to know that. You can just read earlier in John, where John says, if we say we have no sin, we deceive ourselves and the truth is not in us. If we say we've not sinned, we're lying. So if you say you're not sinning, you're lying, which is a sin. So if you say you're not sinning, you're sinning, sinner. So it's not saying you'll be perfect, but what it is saying is we'll see progress. And let me close by saying this progress brings struggle. Let me give you two illustrations and we're done for today. First illustration is my yard. Back in Texas, the first house I ever bought. Donna and I, the house had been terribly mismanaged. Seen most acutely by the condition of the yard. There was no grass at all, not a blade. But there were weeds, millions of weeds, little tiny carpet of weeds, large, robust weeds, taller than me, covering this yard. Now, question, how do the neighbors know a new resident had moved into that house? Because I took a weed eater. And I went nuts on those weeds. I was like a little man in a big salad. It was all wet and it felt like a coleslaw just flying around. Ah! And we began to dig them up and we began to till up the soil and we began to plant seeds and we began to nourish the soil. And over time, there were less weeds and more grass. Now, a couple months later, was there a lot of grass? No. It was like, hey, I see a blade of grass. And were there still weeds? Yes, quite a few. So much so, in fact, that if you were new to the town and just driving by, you might have driven by that yard and go, well, clearly no one lives there. Look at all those weeds. And you'd be wrong because you hadn't seen the progress over time. And I say that to warn some of you who just like to try to discern who's a real Christian or not based on their activity. You don't know what God's doing in someone's heart in a moment. You have to see progress over time. On the night Jesus was betrayed, two men went running off into the dark. Judas, who'd betrayed him, and Peter, who betrayed him as well. And if you and I were standing there in that moment and I went, quick, which one's a real Christian? You would say, neither. They're both denying him. And yet Judas, we're told later, the devil was in him. But Peter, what happened when he ran away from his king? He wept. It broke his heart. It seemed like the right thing, but afterwards it felt wrong. And then he didn't make his way back to Jesus. Jesus went and found him on the beach, and Jesus cooked him breakfast. And Jesus said, "Do you love me?" And Peter says, "You know I do." And then Jesus begins to work to take the wound of his sin out to restore his beloved Peter. So you be careful if you want to judge who's a Christian or not, because you'd condemn a Peter along with a Judas. You don't know what God's doing over the span of someone's life. Sometimes we can make some really ugly decisions, and yet God is still working on us. The trick is his seed abiding in me? How do you know? When I put my faith in Jesus, he begins to change me from the inside out, and I will see progress. Less weeds, more grass over time. But as soon as I say that, let me sober some of you. That does not mean, yeah, so whatever, y'all gotta accept me. I can do whatever I want. No, the person whose heart's been changed by a king like this wants to sing. We wanna celebrate him. We sing in here because of what he's done. We don't want to revel in what he bled out to destroy. So we see progress, but that progress involves struggle. And that's what this series is going to be about. I know today was more philosophical and theological. We're about to get intensely practical over the next couple weeks, but I wanted to lay the baseline. Before we talk about what you do, you need to know what God has done for you. And yet we understand that this progress will require struggle. But let me say this about the struggles we close. I think about the movie Saving Private Ryan, The Beaches of Normandy. That terrible scene in the movie where you're watching those men in that firefight on the beach. There's two kind of soldiers in a firefight like that. One looks peaceful and serene, calm. The other looks agitated and nervous. One looks undisturbed, completely at ease. The other looks fearful, anxious. What's the difference? The one who looks calm in the battlefield is dead. Dead soldiers don't flinch when a bullet hit strikes nearby. Dead soldiers don't duck when a bomb goes off because they're dead. It's the alive who are most acutely aware of the struggle, because they're alive. And I talk to so many believers that say, I believe this, that Jesus is canceling sin and he's changing me, but I still struggle. And some of you, you've had struggles with addictions and propensities and discouragements for years. And what the enemy has begun to do is begin to tell you, yeah, that's because you don't really know him. That's because he doesn't really love you. That's because you're not really one of his people. That's because you're not really saved. You don't really know God. And he begins to say, that struggle is proof that you're not alive. But I'm here to tell you, the fact that you're aware of the struggle, the fact that you are struggling, does not mean you're not alive. It's one of the greatest assurances that you are. The dead aren't aware of a spiritual battle. It's the alive who most acutely see it raging in me and hate it. God, I want to see this change in me. I want to see it change out there. I want to see it change here. God, will you move? Will you heal? Will you restore? Will you bring peace where there's anger? Will you bring calm where there's anxiety? Will you bring endurance where there's a flagging of my zeal? Will you help me love you when my heart feels cold? It's that awareness of the struggle that might be your greatest evidence that you're alive. So the trick is, how do we struggle well? If spirituality is a fight, our King has won the decisive victory. He has rendered the enemy defeated. And yet we're still on the battlefield. And John ends this passage by saying, one day we will see him again. And when we see him, we'll become like him because we'll see him as he is. And he says, and all who have that hope purify themselves as he is pure. The King who has come for us is coming again. And he told us, but in this world, you will have trouble. but I'm using it for my purposes. I want to use you for my glory in a hurting world. And one day all this will be gone. I've broken the penalty of sin. I've fractured its power in your life. One day its very presence will be gone. But now is the day of struggle. And so as we journey through this series, we're going to figure out how to struggle well with the hope of knowing I'll see him and I'll be like him. So I'm going to run in the path of his commands because he set me free.
If you were encouraged by today's talk, be sure to rate us and hit subscribe on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you stream your podcast. To experience other talks, videos, and live gatherings, visit us online at PassionCityChurch.com or download the Passion Movement app. And again, thank you for listening to the Passion City Church DC podcast.